From Kansas to California, Wyoming to Hawaii, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, family safety at public events is a growing concern. James A. DeMeo is author of What's Your Plan? And he's here to explain what steps you can take to protect your family. The Alabama U.S. Senate race is heating up, and a special congressional election nears in North Carolina. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Are mandatory eviction laws contributing to the problem of felons reoffending? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine takes a look at the issue with Bob McNamara from the Institute for Justice. And there is a difference between freedom and liberty, and that difference is personal responsibility. So says Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Bombs, guns, and even vehicles have been used to create a growing number of mass casualty events. This has caused many Americans to become uneasy when going into public places, especially crowded venues. There are steps you can take to protect yourself and your family. James A. DeMeo is author of the book, What's Your Plan? A Step-by-Step Guide to Keeping Your Family Safe. He is here to talk about how to do that. James, welcome to American Radio Journal. James, before we get into talking about exactly what people should do in the event they find themselves in an emergency situation, tell us a little bit about your background and how it is you came to author a book that explains to people how they should plan for these emergencies.
Absolutely. Thank you for the conversation. James A. DeMeo, 29 years in the security industry, 21 of which I was with the Nassau County Police Department on Long Island, New York. I retired from law enforcement in 2011 and transitioned into my second career. So I've been a published author. I teach for Tulane University, distance learning, and I am a proactive risk mitigation strategist in terms of trying to keep people safe within confined spaces.
And, of course, we've had just a little over a week ago two more tragic incidents of shootings, mass shootings in public places, a Walmart in one case in Dayton, Ohio, folks who were just out for the night in a bar on a street enjoying themselves. So I'm sure a lot of Americans, James, are saying, we're maybe a little concerned now about being in a public space with a large group of people. What can people do to prepare themselves for the possibility of an active shooter?
The past week has been tragic on so many levels, you know, El Paso and obviously, you know, Dayton and California, the San Jose area. But I always remind people to, you know, get past the fear factor and be empowered in terms of having a situational awareness mindset on how to best deal with these challenges. So again, I wrote this book in 2017. It's to empower families on knowing what to do when faced with true emergency situations. So I always talk about having a conversation with your family before you go to an event or a place of worship or any type of confined space that you know exactly you know, where you're going to meet. Any event is an emergency. You have unique code word for your family. You've obviously have fully charged cell phones, but you've created a pre-planned response on how to best deal with these challenges. So in the event something does tragic happen, something is happening, as law enforcement is responding to the scene, you've already created your pre-planned response on how to survive that kind of situation.
Let's talk about specific different areas where folks could be. And let's start out, you mentioned a church, and we did have a mass shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh here last year. And a lot of Americans, many Americans, if not most, do go to church or synagogue or mosque and are in that confined space. So if you find yourself in a situation, James, where you're in a house of worship and a situation with an active shooter arises, what do you do?
Well, certainly you want to be aware of your immediate surroundings. See something, say something, run, hide, fight. But as you enter that space, you know exactly how you're going to get in, how you're going to get out. If there is a fellow parishioner next to you that it looks like they're having a bad day, you need to let somebody in a position of authority within that space know, you know, that there's a potential problem, you know, obviously in your place of worship. But I always talk about just having those key stakeholders, your church leaders, your team leaders, your volunteers come together, know exactly what to do, that they're trained in how to respond to active shooter situations, working with local law enforcement, inviting them down to that site, letting them do walkthroughs, and having their own situational awareness to potential problem within that place of worship.
You mentioned that you work for local law enforcement. What advice do you have for local law enforcement agencies to be prepared? I know in the case of Dayton, James, the Dayton police were on the spot in less than a minute, which is a phenomenal response rate, probably saved hundreds of lives by their preparedness. What should police departments be doing so that they're able to respond in a manner like the police in Dayton did?
They're doing the best they can, you know, with the resources they have. I spent 21 years in law enforcement, certainly. They're trying to get the trust of the public. Again, we can have the largest military and law enforcement agency in the world if we have the American public buy into those public-private partnerships. And again, those mantras of see something, say something, run, hide, fight. But it's really looking for those early attack indicators, you know, that the public, they're aware of things that don't look right. And certainly, again, law enforcement has a very difficult job. They're responding to the scene. In some cases, as you mentioned, they're there within 30 or 60 seconds. As we saw in El Paso, unfortunately, they were not there. It took them a little while to get down to the scene, and the shooter subsequently surrendered. And up to today, I believe there was 22 lives that have been lost as a result of that tragic incident. So it's, again, a collaboration of efforts between the public and law enforcement, sharing information, you know, law enforcement responsibly monitoring social media. And certainly, if there are any key indicators to violence that the public shares them with first responders and law enforcement, obviously, in a timely manner.
How important is see something, say something in terms of preventing an active shooter situation from occurring? And I'm specifically thinking, James, that at least in the case of the shooter in Dayton, Ohio, there was a rather lengthy history of threats of violence and fantasies of violence. Is there a way for the public to contact law enforcement or social service agencies to alert them to potential threats of that sort?
Well, again, terrific question. It's those partnerships that we talked about, and certainly social service agencies, law enforcement, whatever the public is seeing on social media, if it's alarming to them, to reach out to their local first responders. Again, we have those fusion centers. We have the JTTF. We have from the top down and the bottom up. But we saw in Parkland, again, there was some missing links. So there were the early attack indicators towards violence. So we can't just think that somebody else is going to take care of the problem. We have to come forward as a nation and share that information. One of the things that I learned in law enforcement is everything is the real thing until proven otherwise. So if we share that information, you know, we have law enforcement, the authorities properly vet that. You know, we'll err on the side of being cautious during very difficult, trying times.
The one type of situation we haven't discussed is if you are at a sporting event or a concert in a large stadium or outdoor venue, are there any special steps that you should take for you and your family to protect them if you're in that situation?
Well, yes, that's a great question. It's chapter one of my book. And when we look at sports and entertainment venues, we're looking at confined spaces. We look at the Las Vegas shooting. No one could figure out why the shooter did what he did. So, and the security industry is known as a black swan event, unprecedented, 32 floors up into confined space. But when you go into those spaces, you know exactly where you parked your car. You know that you went through gate A, as an example, fully charged cell phones. You have the clothing descriptions of your children just in case they wander away from you. You're monitoring and enjoying the event, but at the same time, you're utilizing social media inside the stadium to send a text, let's say, to the command center if something seems out of the ordinary. But again, these confined spaces, we're dealing with, you know, potential choke points and bottlenecks as people are ingressing. As you're going through and getting screened, that is a prime target for a terrorist activity on the way in and certainly on the way out. In the Barclays Center in 2012 with AEG, so you can imagine 18,000 Brooklyn Nets fans, you know, coming out of a basketball game, going down into a subway. So that flows into a mass transportation zone. So these are all potential vulnerabilities for sports stadiums and venues throughout the United States.
We have been talking with James A. DeMeo, who is author of the book, What's Your Plan? A Step-by-Step Guide to Keeping Your Family Safe During Emergency Situations. James, I'm sure this is something that most Americans are interested in these days. So where can they go to find your book?
We are on jamesadimeo.com, jamesadimeo.com. We are on Amazon. Feel free to reach out to me. I'm on social media. I'm doing everything I can. But obviously, these kinds of conversations with media leaders like yourself can get the message to, obviously, a larger audience.
James A. DeMeo, author of What's Your Plan? James, thank you for being with us.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much. Take care.
There's a lot going on in the nation's capital these days, but we are going to go out of the capital to the states of Alabama and North Carolina today and talk with Scott Parkinson about political developments in those states. Scott, good to have you here.
It's great to be back.
Let's talk, first of all, about Alabama. We have an open seat in the 1st Congressional District in Alabama. Can you give us the lay of the land there? Why is it open, and how is it shaping up in terms of the candidates?
Representative Bradley Byrne has held the district, and he is running for the United States Senate. He's one of several Senate candidates, and we can talk about the Senate race in a minute. But on July 31st, the Club for Growth endorsed Bill Hightower for the U.S. House of Representatives in the 1st Congressional District of Alabama. Hightower has just a ton of experience in the business community. He's very strong on economic policy and believes in the types of enterprise and freedom that can really get our economy growing at a rapid rate that we haven't experienced in a couple of decades. So at any rate, we like Bill Hightower a lot. He's running in a Republican primary against a couple other candidates. Chris Pringle is one of the contenders, and we've also got another guy named Wes Lambert, who is a restaurant owner, and then we have Jerry Carl, who's the commissioner of Mobile County Board of Commissions. So those are the candidates in Alabama 1, and I guess I would sort of take us over to the Alabama Senate race.
Before you do that, Alabama 1, is that a Republican-leaning district, likely to be a safe Republican seat, or is this going to be a toss-up?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it definitely is. It's something that will hold in the general election. That's why the primary is so competitive.
Okay, and as you mentioned, there is a U.S. Senate race. Now, this is one, give us a little background on this, Scott. A couple of years ago, there was a Republican misfire of major proportions, ended up with a Democrat in the seat. Refresh our listeners as to what happened, and then where are we now?
President Trump nominated Senator Jeff Sessions to be the Attorney General, and after his confirmation, he gives up his Senate seat, and then they designated a special election. Several Republicans got in that race, and what you ultimately saw was a dilemma where Judge Roy Moore found himself running against Mo Brooks and Luther Strange. And so you had various political dynamics at stake where different establishment groups and conservative groups rallied behind different candidates, and there was just strong division in the primary. Ultimately, Roy Moore won the nomination and took on Doug Jones and lost the race. So it was a sort of a slap in the face to conservatives who were supporting Mo Brooks at the time. And Mitch McConnell also got stung with the loss of Luther Strange in the Senate. So now you've got that seat back up, and Doug Jones is the incumbent Democrat, and Republicans are looking at nominating one of several candidates, including Bradley Byrne and Judge Roy Moore. You also have a candidate named Arnold Mooney, who's a state representative, and you have Coach Tommy Tuberville, who's running. He was a longtime Auburn coach. And then you also have the Secretary of State, John Merrill, is running. And among these candidates, Club for Growth is still considering who we may or may not support in this race. I think that when you look at all the Senate races, Alabama is certainly the best opportunity to pick up a Republican seat with Doug Jones holding what is normally a very bright red seat. But we don't think Roy Moore can win, and we'll definitely not be supporting him.
We'll have to continue to monitor that because, as you said, Scott, this looks like the best opportunity for a Republican pickup, and a couple of pickups are going to be needed next year. We'll be talking a lot more about these state-by-state Senate races as the months go by here.
Yeah.
Let's go a little bit north to North Carolina, where in North Carolina's 9th Congressional District, we have a special election shaping up. Some background on that, please.
In the 9th Congressional District of North Carolina, there was alleged voter fraud and ballot harvesting and a lot of things when Mark Harris won the race. So they went to a special election. They never seated anybody after 2018, and that's why you have a special election here. We have previously endorsed State Senator Dan Bishop, and he is running against a young guy named Dan McCready. This is a race where Republicans previously held the district with Congressman Robert Pittenger, And we think it's a big upgrade opportunity with a solid conservative like Dan Bishop. And so we're actually going to be going up on TV and doing some independent expenditures here throughout the month of August, leading on to the September 10th special election.
And in terms of this district, unlike the congressional seat that we talked about in Alabama, this one's a bit of a toss-up, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. This one's a very, very tight race. I think that it's going to get the most national money out of any of the special elections. Republicans have, you know, all this is public record. They have collectively spent over $4 million on behalf of Dan Bishop in a House race. Charlotte is a pretty expensive market, but clearly the TV and radio and digital and mail expenditures. Also, you got to look at field work. This is the game in town. Democrats have a lot more money on hand. They've been able to raise sizable funds for Dan McCready, but I also think that Republicans have been showing up pretty well in the special election. So we've got a real good shot at holding the seat and electing Dan Bishop. Either way, I think on Election Day, it's going to definitely be within 5 points.
We, of course, will have results of that when the special election is held on September 10th. We have been talking with Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth, keeping an eye on all these key political races shaping up around the country. And Scott, tell us a bit about the Club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of our nation's capital. We have over 250,000 members from every state in America, and we also encourage everybody to check us out on our website, www.clubforgrowth.org. And if you like what you see, you can actually become a member of the Club for Growth for free. Enter in your email address, and we'll start sending you updates. I'd also encourage your folks and your listeners to check us out on Twitter at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Scott, we'll check back in with you next week.
Great. Thank you.
Laws requiring the automatic eviction of those who have committed certain crimes are leading to homelessness and reoffending. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explores the impact with Bob McNamara from the Institute for Justice.
Imagine that you could get kicked out of your house or kicked out of your apartment because someone that you live with committed a crime. You could be completely innocent, but thanks to compulsory eviction laws, you could find yourself homeless. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Bob McNamara. He is a senior attorney at the Institute for Justice, and the Institute for Justice, of course, great friends of the program here. We have their attorneys on all the time. They have just launched a new case. This one is based in Granite City, Illinois, where they are challenging one of these so-called compulsory eviction laws that give local officials the power to kick people out of their housing if someone else who lives in that same house or apartment has committed a crime. Bob, thanks so much for taking some time and being here with us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
As I said, Bob, you guys have just launched this new case in Granite City, Illinois. It's one of those places that has a compulsory eviction policy on the books. And maybe we should just start there by defining what this is, because I imagine very few of our listeners at this moment, Bob, are living in Granite City, Illinois. But these are rules that are popping up in a lot of places around the country. So what is a compulsory eviction policy?
They are, and they're a growing phenomenon. And what compulsory eviction means is a city ordinance that says if you rent your home and any member of your household, and that's defined as a member of your family, or even just a house guest or a friend who stays overnight, if any member of your household commits a crime anywhere, it becomes mandatory for your landlord to evict you. Your landlord can actually be fined and even lose his business license if he doesn't, on his own steam, using his own money, evict you from your home.
This strikes me as one of those laws that you might pass because it sounds good. You want greater law and order. You want to decrease crime. You want to get the criminals out of your town, you know, kick them out, make them live somewhere else. But this just ends up sort of overreaching as negative consequences. Is that the case here?
You would think so, but laws like these don't punish people who commit crimes. They punish the friends, parents, and roommates of people who commit crimes. And there's probably no better example of that than the actual clients in this case, Jessica Barron and Kenny Wiley. Jessica and Kenny haven't committed any crime. They're not accused of committing any crime. And actually, no one in their family is accused of committing any crime here. The crime was committed by a friend of their teenage sons who stayed with them for a while over this past winter. It was cold out. It was winter. Jessica and Kenny felt bad for this kid who was fundamentally homeless, and they let him stay in their house for 4 or 5 days a week over the winter when it got cold. While he was staying with them, he got into some trouble. They eventually kicked him out because he was a poor house guest. But he also committed a burglary about a mile away. He broke into a restaurant overnight. He was immediately sentenced to probation. It took about 30 days for him to be back out on the street. But Jessica and Kenny stand to lose their home, where they've lived for 2 years. They have kind of a rent-to-own arrangement with the landlord. They hope to eventually buy the place. But they have to be kicked out under Granite City's law because this kid who was staying with them committed this burglary. And the crazy thing is, Jessica and Kenny have to be kicked out under the law, but once they're kicked out, the landlord is free to rent it to anyone he wants. He can actually rent their house to the kid who committed the burglary, if he feels like it. So this has nothing to do with punishing criminals and nothing to do with preventing crime. It's just a way of kind of holding tenants strictly liable for the crimes of anyone who they, out of the goodness of their hearts, let sleep in their house.
We are talking with Bob McNamara. He's a senior attorney at the Institute for Justice, and we're talking about a case that they have just launched in Granite City, Illinois. And Bob, if the situation is as you describe it there, and it sounds like the family involved really did everything right, or, I mean, at the very least, they didn't do anything wrong, and yet they're still, you know, they may lose their housing over this. I just want to push back a little bit on this and suggest that maybe the situation in Granite City is a poor application of the law, and obviously poor application of the law, but does it really indict the law itself, or is this a situation where maybe these city officials have just overstepped in one case, but the law itself is still beneficial?
I think it's absolutely an indictment of the law, because the only thing this law adds to sort of every other law on the books is the ability to punish innocent people, and to punish innocent people once the criminal's out of the picture. If you want to punish criminals, you should punish criminals. You should put them in prison. You should prevent them from committing more crimes. And if you want to stop people from maintaining a nuisance in their property, if you say, hey, you know, this house is dangerous, there's a lot going on in this house, you can sue them in nuisance. The only thing these compulsory eviction laws add is the ability to say, oh, okay, Jessica and Kenny, we get that you didn't do anything wrong, and we get that you're not currently harboring anyone who is a criminal or anyone who is dangerous, but we want to kick you out anyway because we, kind of in our boundless discretion as the city government, have decided you're not the sort of people who get to live in our town. And so we want you out of that house. Only out of that house, though. Jessica and Kenny are free to rent anywhere else they want in Granite City, to the point where they live in a single-family home, but if it were a duplex, their landlord could literally comply with the law by moving them into the other half of the duplex, and then they'd be compliant. So it's really, to be honest, insane. It's a way of punishing and harassing people who aren't wealthy enough to own their home by taking away one of the few property rights they have, which is their lease, or in Jessica and Kenny's case, this rent-to-own arrangement they have, extinguishing that just because it doesn't rise to the level of actually holding title to their home. But at bottom, it's nothing but harassment and has nothing to do with actual crime prevention.
Yeah, definitely another erosion of property rights. As you said, Bob, it gives these local officials really boundless discretion. That's the phrase you used. I think that's a good one, to go after people who are peacefully living in homes that they've legally rented. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Unfortunately, we are out of time for today. You can find more information about this case by clicking over to ij.org. That's the website for the Institute for Justice. And joining us today from the Institute for Justice, Bob McNamara. Thanks for taking some time today, Bob.
Thanks for having me.
And again, that's Bob McNamara. He's a senior attorney at the Institute for Justice. You can find them online at ij.org. Check out everything we're working on at reason.com. And for Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can catch me again next week right here on another edition of American Radio Journal.
There is a lot of talk these days about individual rights, but not much discussion about the responsibilities that accompany those rights. Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, discusses the responsibilities of liberty on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Whether it be the horrific loss of life in the most recent tragedies in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio, or the restrictions on freedom of speech on a college campus, the liberties of our citizens are under assault. A loss of life is the ultimate theft of liberty, and recent actions point to a despicable trend to steal our liberties as well as our lives. Our Declaration of Independence states that we have certain unalienable rights. Those rights are not just words. They mean something, especially to those who served in the military, supporting and defending our Constitution and our liberties. The concept of liberty recognizes our rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Liberty includes those inalienable rights given to all created. Freedom implies the ability to act, such as freedoms of speech, religion, assembly, and to bear arms. The minute one's freedoms trample on the liberty of another, then conflict ensues and must be resolved. The differences between freedom and liberty are significant. Within the concept of liberty comes a measure of personal accountability and responsibility. The concept of freedom is within the purview of government with the consent of the governed in our Constitution. Nowhere, however, does one's misbehaviors have the right to take away another's freedoms and liberties. Our nation is at a crossroads. Whenever the lines between freedom and liberty become blurred, government almost always oversteps its bounds. We all have freedom of speech, for example. When government decides that it can restrict our speech because it does not like what it hears, your liberties have been limited. Where liberty is concerned, we have the personal responsibility to recognize the consequences of our actions, and we must be willing to hold accountable those who have taken such actions. The distinction between freedom and liberty is the basis of government and political discourse, and it will be forever debated. But what cannot be understated is the importance of personal accountability and responsibility. The discourse between freedom and liberty becomes clearer when interpreted in the light of personal accountability and responsibility. One of the first leadership principles that all Marines and service members learn is to take responsibility for your actions. That leadership principle is the basic premise for virtually every other character trait and leadership principle that the military teaches. In a society which fails to exercise control within a recognized societal framework, the absence of personal responsibility will wreak havoc on those citizens and their attempt to improve their lot in life. Personal responsibility is a critical aspect of accountability, and most importantly, it is also a right. The right to accept personal responsibility is essential to any individual exercising free will and to the society at large for its own long-term survival and growth. The Founding Fathers in the Declaration of Independence were quite clear in their exhortation when they said, and I quote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among those are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness," end quote. The Founding Fathers took responsibility for their actions. They achieved liberty because of divine intervention and their willingness to pledge their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. Personal responsibility is a sacred right, a sacred honor, and an integral part of liberty. The past 50 years have seen countless examples in which personal responsibility was shunned with disastrous effect. For some reason, our problems seem to be someone else's fault, and the governed seek to restrict the liberties of others. Liberty has been denied by placing restrictions on our freedoms because of the actions of another. When a society becomes convinced that all their woes are the result of someone else's actions and that government intervention solves problems, the concept of personal responsibility and the liberty that personal responsibility brings are lost. Personal responsibility does bring freedom. It is liberating to realize that you can influence your own life without having your government intervene on your behalf. Taking personal responsibility is about leadership and self-discipline. Personal responsibility is so crucial to the rule of law in any economy. As soon as the concept of personal responsibility deteriorates, the normal function of an economy and a society are impeded and may in fact implode. Most importantly, you can begin the process of taking responsibility by looking inwardly for solutions to your problems and not seeking governmental intervention as the quick fix. For the American Radio Journal, this is Colonel Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country. They include WCPC-AM in Tupelo, Mississippi, WITK-AM in Wilkes-Barre, Scranton, Pennsylvania, along with WYDF-AM in Alexandria, Louisiana. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.